Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian and my co-host is Austin Chadwick. And today we have Scott Ford with us. And we're going to be talking a little bit about legacy code, refactoring, and knowing when to start and when to stop. So Scott, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit and we can get going.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having me. So I am the co-founder and chief code whisperer at Quirkybates. We are an organization that focuses exclusively on helping teams improve the software systems they already have instead of building new ones from scratch. And it is kind of born out of my passion of like, I really like improving things, whether it be software or things in the physical world.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I have to say, I'll fanboy a bit here. Big fan of of Quirkybates, of your work, and your podcast as well. So I've listened to several episodes. And so that's Legacy Code Rocks, right?
Yeah, that's right. Legacy Code Rocks. Yeah, and then we have the podcast, and we have a Slack community that we've tried to build. And then we have a virtual meetup group that's kind of part of that as well.
Fantastic.
So I often joke it's a support group for people who are working on older projects. So
yeah, I've been to a few of those and they've been a lot of fun. So I encourage people to join in, especially if you're working on some really difficult legacy code. It's a great place to get ideas for sure. So your passion for legacy code, you've kind of built a company around it. You have a lot of focus. You're very passionate. You've talked about it a lot. What created your passion and stoked it and how did that go forward?
It's interesting. So I think the passion has kind of always been there. The idea to focus on it, I think, is what was new. I job hopped a lot early in my career. I think my average tenure at a place was about 8 months, 9 months, for the first, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, after graduating university. And I think there was only one company on my resume I hadn't worked for twice. So, which was really weird. Like I kept going back. I guess I wasn't burning any bridges, but just not super happy. So I left. And it wasn't until years later when I was chatting with Andrea, my business partner, who's also my wife, because we had ended up in a similar situation with Quirkybates where I didn't like the client work we were doing. And I had always thought, so it's like, maybe I don't like working at product companies. I'll work at a services company, but that didn't work. Maybe I didn't like working at that product company, so I'll go work at a different product company. Maybe I didn't like working at that services company, so I'll work at a different services company. Maybe I just need to be my own boss, but still finding myself in this like area of dissatisfaction, like, you know, a few months into the work. And so, you know, Andre like took me through this exercise of like, what was it about all those jobs that you did like? Like, because you wouldn't have taken them if you didn't like them. I was like, well, like almost all of them, like the first couple of weeks was like, go learn all this stuff. Like there's like, you know, here's this big code base we have and this mountain of issues. To learn it, we want you to fix bugs. Okay. So having a lot of fun fixing bugs and doing some refactoring and would often introduce testing practices at the same time or other agile practices at the same time. And then I would hit like this magic, across this magical threshold, at least magical to me anyway, where I was told to switch my energy to features and stop doing improvement work. And I think that's the point at which I became dissatisfied. And that's the point at which I started looking for something else. Because I think it was kind of a combination of so much new to learn, that combined with the cleanup is kind of what was keeping me interested. I've since learned just recently, I was undiagnosed with ADHD at the time. So that might've contributed. So I think the idea to have Quirkybates only do cleanup work was kind of became a forcing function of then that's the only kind of work we'll do. And that's the kind of work I like doing. So we won't have to try to convince our clients that they need to do it by taking on a client and trying to convince them that they need to clean things up. By nature of them becoming a client, they'll have bought in at least partly to cleaning things up. And so that's the work that we'll get to do.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I like that idea because there is like something magical about taking a problematic code base and just like working out all the issues until it's stable. You know, I just happened to like also like feature work, but like I can see that. I can totally see like, you know, you just kind of run to this end and then they've all dried up, the bugs are gone. And now it's like, I must move on now. It was very nice working with you. I love it. It's cool.
I've got like a story idea for like a work of fiction that I might like, I've written like a first chapter. I think I've drafted it for a blog post. But it's like, this idea of like the Ronin, like traveling samurai who like goes from village to village and helps out like somebody who does that on code bases.
I love it.
And getting to that point where like my work is done here, and bowing out and leaving.
So maybe we can get like a little bit more like process oriented real fast. With legacy code, say you're like contacted and it's like, here's a bunch of legacy code. Like, what do you do? You know, it's like, hey, we have tons of bugs or we can't add a feature without breaking the system. What is some of the things that you do, or maybe the advice that people get at the meetup that you see, and you know, what's the typical kind of routine maybe if there is one?
I first like to understand like what the motivation for changing is, and also the motivation for making a change and the motivation to want to keep what they've got. So the organization shows up with a code base, they could throw it away. I'm sure that's the advice they're getting from nearly every other vendor they contacted. But they called us. So kind of getting a sense of why do they want to hold on to it? And then what is it about it that either it's the way their team's interacting with it, like what kind of outcome are they looking for? And so starting with that, and then looking through that lens of, you know, what do they want to get out of the system? What do they want to get out of the project for improving it? And then doing an analysis that we call a code inspection. And we put together like a pretty detailed report for that. That can be overkill for some smaller projects. So if people are like, I really just want to ask you a few questions and, you know, we might not even hire you. You know, what can you do for us then? So then I'll like just do a screen pairing session where like I don't have to set up a development environment, because for like code inspection, we'll set up a development environment, we'll try to run the tests, we'll like really dig in and see what like the experience is like for setting up the dev environment, we'll give feedback on that. Like, you know, we look at a lot of different metrics that we look at to compile, pull a report together. And for some projects, that's overkill. So what we do for them is, you know, just 2-3 hour, screen pairing sessions and then write up a short, you know, based on what I saw, you know, don't have access to your code in that case. I sometimes don't have access to, you know, any kind of documentation, but kind of, you know, based on my memory, the questions I was able to ask, you know, here's my recommended next steps.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I like that idea that it's like, hey, you know, how hard is it to set up your environment? Here's my feedback. Like,
yes.
That's really interesting. That hadn't crossed my mind before. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah. And sometimes like sometimes it's not a big deal for organizations. Like, you know, we've worked with some companies in the past where, you know, all of their hardware for every developer is very specific. They've got it imaged. They just crank out an image and it's got everything baked into it that you would need to be productive on their project. They don't give that to us, unfortunately, often, because, you know, they're not going to issue us hardware just to put a report together. So we end up finding a lot of challenges that, you know, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we don't have those problems because we've kind of bake them out because of process.
Yeah.
Other organizations, like we've had organizations say, you know, it takes us 6 months before someone can be productive. What's contributing to that? And, you know, and at the same time, they may have, you know, a requirement to double the size of the team across the next 12 months. So they're like, we have to double the size of the team and it takes 6 months for anybody to become productive. That's a lot of people who are going to be unproductive for a long time. So that's one of the first things we look at is, you know, how painful is it to set up the development environment? Because that's something, you know, when you double the team, every person you add, they're going to encounter that problem. Whereas if it's just a team that's kind of growing organically, keeping up with attrition, you know, might be the kind of thing that people bump into once every 6 months to a year or two.
Yeah. That makes sense. So I guess how does all of that lead into refactoring and, you know, what are some of the things that you might point out to people there?
Yeah. So, you know, we'll make recommendations, you know, based on what we've seen. And again, trying to look through that lens of like, what are they trying to solve for? So are they trying to solve for, hey, our team needs to double in size? Is that what they're really concerned about? Is the concern our CTO quit and so did half the dev team? We've gotten that call before too. So like literally a lot of knowledge just walked out the door. How do they recover from that? So then it becomes, you know, like, you know, kind of spelunking and trying to, you know, take the material that's there and really sift through it. And that really ends up shaping a lot of the recommendations we make. We almost always will point out like kind of hotspots in the code base where, you know, things are really complex or things aren't well tested or there's a lot of duplication. Those are three things that we look at. And we try to look at those side by side with churn as well. So with those four pieces of information, you know, how much has this file changed over its history? And then we also break that down to like the last 3 months. So like we get like a lifetime of the file and the last 3 months of the file. And then we look at duplication across the file, complexity across the file, per method, but across the file. And then coverage, if we can get it. Sometimes we can't. And, you know, that will often point us in the direction of hotspots. We can say like, okay, this file complexity is really, really high. It's changed 300 times in the last 3 months. Duplication is also incredibly high and you've got zero test coverage. Like you need to really, there's a lot of questions that need to be asked about why that is, right? Mm. Why is it changing so often? Is it changing so often because the business that's being modeled is changing that fast, you know, that much? So, you know, is it the kind of thing where there's a lot of validation that's taking place, a lot of experimentation to try to figure out how to solve a problem, and a lot of things are being tried and rejected? Or is it the result of a lot of bugs that are getting introduced and then fixed, and then while they get fixed, two more introduced, so on and so forth, right? So you can have like a reason for that much change that isn't really bad. It's just kind of a part of doing business. And you can have a reason for that change that's bad that we would want to try to mitigate some other way. But, you know, regardless of why, if you've got that much change going on, you don't want the complexity to be that high because you want it to be, you know, complexity, you know, can be thought of as a good stand-in for creating resistance to being difficult to make things, to change things safely. So lowering that resistance can usually bring out some big wins. So we suggest prioritizing those areas, but like if there's parts of the code base with a really high complexity, but they've never changed, then leave it. Like, you know, we're not like going to recommend to just clean things up for the sake of cleaning them up. You know, the other approach that we'll often try to take is to encourage teams to develop a practice of cleaning up as they go. So like, you don't have to like stop the presses to do refactoring work. You can refactor something small while you're adding a feature. You can refactor something small while you're fixing a bug. You can make any of these small incremental improvements. If you layer them enough, they can have a big impact.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and tying back into a topic at the beginning and then connecting it back to this is the I really like, at least I've heard you and others at Corgi say it, the makers and vendors distinction. And while I do like making new code, I think if I had to pick one, I'd probably be a vendor because I could just hang out and do it all day. And hearing from a fellow mender, so I'm just real fascinated. Okay, you got your sleeves rolled up. You're about to go into this high complexity file with no tests and lots of churn. What are your kind of go-to moves, first moves in there to get started? Whether it's changing the code or helping teach the team, like you can go either direction, I guess. I'm just fascinated here.
Yeah. So whether it's teaching or trying to like, you know, make a change myself, I think the approach I would take is pretty much the same. I'd want to, you know, first make sure my dev environment set up, like, I don't know. I always iterate that. Like, can I run the thing? Can I build the thing? So for any changes that I'm about to make, can I observe them somehow? If I can't, if like there's absolutely zero test infrastructure set up, do I at least know how to get to where I'm at in the code by using the application in some fashion? So either inserting a print statement or putting a breakpoint and seeing like, can I manipulate the application from the outside as someone who's consuming it and get to the point where I'm trying to clean up? Do I at least understand like that really, really high level path? Mm-hmm. And then I'll often write some kind of automated test that acts at that level, just as a smoke test. And it might not even be validating much. It's probably just validating that it doesn't crash, but it's validating a lot more than it used to because there were no tests. So you have at least validated that much. And because I'm lazy, I won't have to click all those buttons anymore. So now I've got a pretty quick way to, you know, exercise the app to get to where I want to be. And I can, you know, built up some confidence. I know how to do that. Then I will start, you know, adding in some tests by like, you know, usually do an extract method, you know, getting code that I think I want to change, into a test. Another practice I like that I learned from Lilan Falco and Arlo Belshi is read by refactoring. I really like that approach. Like, so anytime you're kind of confused about something, you really lean on the refactoring tools that you have available. If you have them, not all environments do. When you do have them, you lean on them and really take advantage of those. I like tests in that scenario where it's like, I'm looking at a system that I don't know anything about. The tests that I'm writing are really like, each test is like a question about the system. So it's like, does the thing do X or does the thing do Y? And what I'm really trying to do is like, sometimes these are called like pinning tests, where I'm trying to like put a pin in the current functionality to both understand it. And then it's, once I've got it, I can keep it and use that as a check to make sure that I don't break anything unintentionally later. Because I'm going, you know, I'm in here to make some sort of change. You know, if it's a pure refactoring, then I don't want any behavior to change. Or if I'm here because I'm fixing a bug, then I do want behavior to change. I want that bug to be fixed, but I might not want to introduce any others.
Like vice test or pinning test, like is pinning tests and vice tests kind of the same thing? Is that what you understand?
So, yeah, I always think of like sticking a pin in a map or something like that. I don't know if that's the intention for the...
Like
the
vicing definition. A piece of wood so that you can carve it, right? Like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, really kind of, you know, getting some understanding about how that's working. Sometimes it might be easier to ask those questions in like a REPL, if that's kind of more intuitive to people. So to be able to try to consume the thing. So instead of, you know, consuming what you're working with all the way in from the UI, can you consume it, you know, programmatically? From a REPL that can teach you a lot as well. It can teach you like what to put in your test. But I've also been like found like a really good kind of hybrid between those two approaches is like an interactive document. So like a Jupyter Notebook or something like that, where not only do you have like this REPL like experimentation capability, but you also have an artifact of what you've run and what the results were, and the ability to play that back again. Like you can like just play the whole file again. So those are techniques for just kind of like gaining understanding of like what's here, what's it do, what I want to make sure it keeps doing. And then it feels safe enough to go ahead and make the change that I want to make. And I often think about that as like spreading out safety equipment, so to speak. It's like, I'm about to do something that's dangerous, right? Like, depending on the context of the system, it could be life-threatening, or it could be, threaten somebody's livelihood in terms of monetary issues, or, there's some care and attention that helps to put out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love those analogies, because I think that can help a lot is like the one that's often used is the safety net, right? Mm-hmm. Would you walk across a balance beam with no safety net over 50 stories, right? But if it was under a super sturdy safety net that people are jumping on next to it, you're like, oh, okay, I'll try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I
wrote a blog post a while ago about like this idea that when a team first gets started, like that balance beam or that tightrope they're walking across is probably really low to the ground. So the risk for them of falling off was just to put their foot down. And then as the risk got more and more, the tightrope kind of kept getting raised up. But they got better at walking the rope, right? So it was genuinely okay for them to not have a net, because they fell very infrequently. And when they did, it wasn't a huge deal, like, relative to the cost of them stringing up a net, right? Like they didn't see the impact. It wasn't until somebody new came to the team and said, I'm not getting up there, that it becomes a problem.
Fantastic analogy. I love that.
Yeah. I think
that came from a CEO or CFO for an organization. Like we produced one of our reports for them, and they're like, oh my gosh, how did this get so bad? How could, like, we hire really smart people, how could any reasonable person have let it get this way? And I always try to, look at existing code bases from the idea and the assumption, like kind of like the agile retrospective prime directive, that no matter what's happened, no matter what we ended up with, everybody did their best. And their best is constrained by the constraints of knowledge, time, stress, tools that they have at their disposal. But what we're looking at is somebody's best. Trying to imagine a scenario where, like, okay, how could we have ended up with what we have and it be somebody's best? And try to like walk backwards from there and remember, all the awful code that I've written in the past that I hope nobody's, I hope no one is maintaining some of that stuff.
Nice. Yeah. And I think I've been on projects where there wasn't emphasis on cleaning as you go. And you're right. Week one, month one, year one, it was kind of like, we're falling off sometimes, but it's not a big hurt. But then like year two, people are breaking arms and that bar has gotten, that beam has gotten higher. And it's like, what happened? Yeah. Cool. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, so one other, I've drawn a lot of inspiration from like the home improvement as a metaphor. Mm. And cause it was like, while watching this old house that I was like, I want to do that. And Andrea thought, cause she was watching with me, she thought I meant I wanted to go remodel houses for a living. I'm like, no. What they're doing to that house, I want to do for software systems. And, so from watching a lot of DIY, like home improvement shows, sometimes on those shows, you'll see where like one person just adopts the role of just keeping the work site clean. Mm. They do the sweeping, they throw the trash away, they make sure all the tools get put back where they go. And the other people who are working don't have to stress about that as much. And the teams that have somebody who like adopts that role without judgment, without grudging anybody else, are like really productive. And so sometimes you'll see that like at a competition show where like one team member is like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just gonna keep the place clean. And I saw that like on a home improvement reality program once, where they're like pitting two teams against each other, and the team that had the person who's cleaning up behind them, like they got some stuff done. And so
yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That technical debt is held back, and so people aren't slipping off of stuff and falling into wooden beams and stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah. and asking, where did I put my screwdriver? Where's the screwdriver? It's like
there's another analogy that I'd heard in the past, where it's like sushi chefs will actually clean as they go, right? Because they create waste, but then it's like their whole place for like making something is all in the same spot, and so they quickly run out of space if they're not cleaning as they go. For us as software developers, if you can build with an infinite number of Legos, then you can basically just create an infinite amount of Legos on the floor for you to step
That's
on
right.
while you're in the day. So,
and if you know the path that's safe through that in the dark, and you're not going to step on anything, and it's not so painful for you, but
yeah,
it's the others that's painful.
Well, inspired by this, I might dub myself as my mob's janitor. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, the mob janitor. No, I need you a mob programming role.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I like the term mender a little bit better. Mender,
yeah. You know, pay attention to whether or not everybody has water, right? You know, because it's, you know, the team, you know, kind of in a mob context, like, is everybody well rested? Does it look like anybody needs a break, you know? Having somebody pay attention to, you know, the work product and the team kind of mental state. You can see that being helpful.
Oh yeah.
When do you know like when to start and when to stop?
Starting's easy.
Yeah.
Starting is usually because, you know, somebody said, I want this to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I'm always excited. I look around the world and I see nothing but things I could be spending my time on. So I guess like the when to start almost in some context can be like deciding what to start on. Like it's almost like, so usually try to like, if I'm just out randomly picking something, try to make it something that I'm passionate about or something that I care about. So it'll hold my focus, my attention, again, the ADHD. But also like, you know, client comes to us and says, please start, right? But then the stopping is a lot harder. Because I think something that I've noticed with mentors over the years is we love improving things. We like, we genuinely get a joy. We get jazzed out of making things better. But and mentors are highly trained to identify things that could be better, right?
Yeah.
That combination can be dangerous if left unchecked, because you can be, you know, polishing something that just, it's okay. It doesn't need to be that clean. And so trying to make sure you build in some kind of feedback loop with someone who can evaluate, is this enough? And stop you when they say stop. I don't think the mentor should ever be in the driver's seat for whether or not we're done, because the mentor always think it can be better. Like that's kind of just by definition. And I think like, if you have the mentors on your team and you're like, just if you let them know that ahead of time, like when we tell you to finish this effort, it's going to feel dissatisfying for you. You're going to feel like we stopped too early. You know, like we recognize that, you know, we'll try to find something interesting to work on. But when we think you need to be done, please don't fight us. Right. So, but I think, you know, kind of having that understanding of like, you know, where people's motivations are, if you see somebody get really frustrated, like, oh, we shouldn't be stopping this right now. You know, one, they could be right. Right. So always consider that they might be right. But two, it might be because, you know, their tolerance for mess is a lot different than yours. And that's why they're on the team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if things are like, if things are falling well below your tolerance for mess, and you're okay accumulating, you're okay getting back to creating some mess, then you can, you know, find a different role for that vendor.
Yep. Yeah, I found a really fascinating combination of exactly what you're talking about with mobbing. So I think in that, I think I'm a mender and I would go forever, maybe, or at least how what some people perceive as forever. I do have a stopping point, because when I do code alone, I do stop eventually cleaning. But what I've noticed is every mob I'm on, I hit their breaking point. So it's like, okay, that's enough. We'll stop there. And I'm like, okay, I might have had four more refactorings, but three other reasonable individuals think it's clean enough. And so that gives me peace about stopping, because in that moment, in that context, people I respect and that are very smart are telling me that's enough. And I'm like, okay, good. I feel good about stopping now. So that kind of psychological feedback can really help a mender.
Yeah. And I try to reserve my battles for things that I think are really problematic. And like, this is kind of also part of the, you know, when to start. You know, there have been times in code bases where, you know, we've been brought in to do one thing and we found something else. And like, this is what we have to do first. So like, there's one client several years ago, all their passwords for their user accounts were stored in plain text. It's like, that's what we're doing first. We don't even know how to deploy yet, but we're doing that first. Like, we will figure out how to deploy when we fix that. Because that has to be fixed first. And just like, it's going to be probably the most expensive change we make in terms of how inefficient we are. Mm-hmm. But you know, and sorry that that's not what you hired us for. You hired us to make the site faster, right? But this has to, your application collects money from people.
Right. Yeah,
that's not okay. You gotta.
There's an and on cord to pull sometimes, right? Yes.
Yeah. And so, like, so making sure, like, when you are gonna kind of like put your foot down and like, you know, like, no, this is what we're doing first. Don't try to overuse that on the, but there's three more refactorings we could do, right? Because it's almost like it starts to erode your own credibility, and I think your own energy, because it takes some mental energy to make that case. And if you're always making it for really small refinements, then you know, your credibility and your energy are getting wasted.
Yeah. Well, I could talk about this all day, but we're coming up on our time here. Scott, do you have anything that you'd like to plug or share before we wrap up the episode?
I think some, you know, things to plug would be great. So if anybody is looking for some help out there, you know, give us a look. If you are a mender and looking for a home, check out the Legacy Code Rocks community. And you know, that can be a great place to hang out. Also, my business partner, Andrea, who I've mentioned a couple times already, she's working on a book. It's called Empathy-Driven Software Development. So if that's something that's interesting to you or your friends, give it a look and check it out. And it'll be, I don't know when the publication date is, but she's working on it, and she's building her own community around that. So if you'd like to join and get involved with that, you can look that up and get involved there.
Great. Thank you. And we'll have links in the show notes for our audience members out there. If you know somebody who's currently mired in legacy code and they haven't seen the show yet, please share this episode with them. I think it'll be really helpful to them. And with that, like and subscribe, click the notification bell and all that stuff. And we'll see you next time. And thank you, Scott, for being with us. And thank you to our audience for watching. Bye, everybody.
Thanks.